You're listening to a highlight from the Yishai Fleisher Show on Voice of Israel.
Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show here on Voice of Israel, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Where are we? We are at the end of one of the five books of Moses. We're coming this Shabbat to the end of the book of Numbers, the book of Bamidbar, what I like to call In the Desert, or the book of politics, the book of Jewish politics, where we're really going to be dealing with, in this week's Torah portion, the kind of end of Moses' life in the sense that this is the last of his actions before the last book of the Bible, which is really one long speech, the book of Deuteronomy, the book of Devarim. And here, this book of politics and book of kind of action, Jewish action, is going to lead us to the dividing up of the land of Israel, the final kind of desert hikes, the desert pathways, journeys that the Jewish people take, all to prepare them to kind of park in the last parking spot where Moses is going to give that speech. And through these two Torah portions, because it's a double Torah portion this Shabbat, we're going to get really the preparation for entering the land of Israel. And all of us, ladies and gentlemen, are preparing to enter the land of Israel. We're living in that time. Some of us have already made it over the pond and are part of the conquering of the land and holding onto it. Some of us are supporting troops around the world, and some of us are just learning about it. But we're in the era of coming home. We're in the era of getting ready for the bigger revelation, which is happening when the Jewish people do come home to the land of Israel. And to help us prepare for that big revelation is none other than our weekly guest, Rabbi Mike Foyer of Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, joining us here for Spiritual Cafe. Hey, Rabbi Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Yishai. It's great to be here.
Okay, so we're in, you agree with me that we're in kind of the it's very military, these two Torah portions.
I would go as far as even to say militant.
Yeah, there's militancy and militarency, meaning to say there are these journeys. Why does the Torah lay out, and this is just a general question about the Torah itself, we believe, we know, that the Bible does not, the scripture, the Torah does not have extra words.
Sure.
Why does it lay out certain things? Sometimes you think, well, who needs this information? Why does it lay out the journeys, the travels from this place to this place, and they parked in this place, and they parked in this place, and they parked in this place? Why is that important to know?
So that question, of course, doesn't only come up here. It comes up in many places that seem to be exhaustively detailed descriptions of things that don't have relevance for future time. So for me, the answer comes on a couple of planes. Number one, you have to remember that for all of the eternal nature of the Torah, it was also given to a very specific generation. And so therefore, sometimes I feel like we're experiencing what was important to them. And so, of course, the list of all the places they'd been was quite significant. On another level, we also look at the narrative, even the narrative portions of the Torah, as having deeper meaning insofar as the letters and words are combinations which make up the names of God. And so it's quite noteworthy that there are 42 journeys in the desert here. And the Magen Avraham, a 17th century sage from, I guess, wasn't really Poland at the time, but would be Poland today, points out that these journeys are all one unbroken statement because they represent the 42-lettered name of God. Mm-hmm. And that's not just sort of a throwaway comment. What he's telling you is that if you take away the local meaning in the narrative, and you even take away the historical meaning, the people actually participated in these, and you actually look at this as an eternal statement, it is expressive of a name of God. And what's a name? A name is a mode of relationship. I call you Yishai because that's who you are to me, but in your deepest core, I'm sure you have names for yourself. So in the same way, it's somehow this journey, the idea of journeying to reach God, is represented by that 42-letter name.
Right. Yesterday, I was talking to a friend about some of my Christian friends, and some of them out there in America get very excited about talking about end times and about...
a lot of press about that right now.
Right, end times and about Armageddon, and dates are coming out, that this is when it's going to happen. And I always shun that kind of stuff. I shy away from it. It's not interesting to me because I very much believe that we're not here to meet the very end. We're here to be a chain on the link on the chain. a part of the story, to move it forward. And when I read these kind of travels of the Jewish people, that exactly tells me that. It's like you go from this place, and this place this happened, and you keep going, you push forward, and you push forward, and you push forward. And it's like, it's not ours to finish. It's not our job to finish it. It's not our job to kind of see the end times. If we get to see the end times, great. But kind of my job is like, okay, where am I really at? I'm in the period of time where the Jewish people are returning to the land of Israel. How could I help that move forward? How can I help God's presence return to the land of Israel? And I'm happy to be on that journey as opposed to frustration of not being at the end time.
I share that sense of process with you, and I would add to it that I'm very wary of apocalyptic thinking, because in my experience, at least from a psycho-emotional standpoint, if not from a theological one, is often just a divestment of responsibility.
Right.
The end is coming. It's coming. Well, hey, but what about all like the stuff that we need to do to make the world the kind of place we want to live in? But the end is coming, right? And I think it's actually a deeply non-Jewish notion, right? I mean, that's why the sages were so filled with these statements. Like, if someone comes and tells you the Messiah is here, don't stop your learning, or don't, you know, you need to keep planting trees. Meaning this idea that God is going to come from the outside and sort of like, and fix everything, or everything's just going to come to an end and a new world will arise. I think it runs counter to the nobility and the agency and the responsibility that humanity has to actually build the world and to do the hard work. Put it to you this way. Is it more powerful to die for what you believe in or to live for it? Right? Our Jewish, holy Jewish ancestors who died in the Crusades, who, you know, crying out the unity of God, that's very powerful. But how about the ones that lived in Poland in the 15th century that got up every single morning and prayed to God and learned and kept the law in despite the tremendous difficulties? Which one's a greater commitment? And I think that living for what we believe in is actually what we're about.
So the other thing that is kind of technically laid out in this week's Torah portions is also the borders of the land of Israel. There's a great description of exactly where you're going to be. There's such an emotional tussle because you know that Moses is saying these things, and you know that he has such a yearning for the land of Israel, and you know that God had already shown him. He kind of raised him up in the last week's Torah portion to the top of a mountain, showed him the land of Israel, and there's a kind of double language of showing the land of Israel, and it's pointed out that he showed him even the hidden caves, the gold, the things that are kind of beneath the surface.
Yeah.
And now he's laying out these borders very, very exactingly. It's like an X-Acto knife. It's like
that's what a border is meant to be.
Right. It's interesting about that. Tell me a little bit about the borders of the land of Israel and every kind of tribe in its border. Why is that so important? Well, today we don't have that same sense. Maybe there's a more fluidity of borders, you know, the European Union, and there's also the sense that the world is a bit borderless.
Sure. I think it has to do with actually arguably one of the most profound messages that we as the Jewish people are meant to bring to the world, which is the idea of union as opposed to unity. What do I mean? You know, on the surface, we're all about one people, one God, one land, 12 tribes. Huh? Right? And you look at the history of the tribes from the time the brothers beat up Joseph and sent him down to Egypt to all the stories in the prophets about what amounts to often civil war, right? And here you're pointing out, like, in this division of the land, isn't it one land? Why do we have to divide it up? How come Reuben has to be over there and Shimon over here? And in the modern era, when we're moving toward these unions and like you said, a borderless world, we say, you Jews are still insisting on being yourselves? Come on. The world doesn't need boundaries. What the world needs is love. The world needs unity. And I got news for you. Unity is a state of being which is unavailable. Because if things truly exist in unity, then I have to cease to be. We're people of union. And in union, that means two separate things come together. And it's actually the border between them which teaches you on some level that they're one. Right? That's why, like, a husband and wife are one. But, you know, think about it. If you and
is that the difference between achdut and echad? Is that
yes,
the same way?
Yes. Or actually, okay, in the Kabbalistic language, between yichud and echad.
Uh-huh.
Right? Yichud, because right. Yichud is union.
Union. Getting together. Coming together.
Right. And it is a union which is always productive. It right. always brings and carries
procreative.
It is procreative right. in its stance. And the often missed point is that it actually depends on the existence of separate entities, right? The best example I can think of is relationships. Think about relationships you've had. insofar as you know who you are in a clean, healthy sense, and the other person knows who they are, so then you can come together and actually have a healthy relationship.
Right.
When one person starts to lose sight of where they begin and the other one leaves off, wouldn't that be like the highest level of relationship? And the answer is, well, no, it tends to be very dysfunctional and unhealthy. In the same way, you know the classic statement, right? Good borders or good fences make good neighbors. Why? Does it mean they don't have to look at him? No, it means that I know exactly where I begin and he ends, so that we can actually relate to each other in a healthy way.
So let's jump off from that to one of the more challenging parts of this Torah portion, which is dealing with the other, dealing with other nations. And I want to read it verbatim. It's verse 50 of chapter 33, book of Numbers.
I'm with you.
Hashem spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab, by the Jordan, by at Jericho, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan to the land of Canaan, you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you, and you shall destroy all their prostration sites, their high places. All their molten images you shall destroy, and all their high places you shall demolish. You shall possess the land, and you shall settle in it. For to you have I given the land to possess it. You shall give the land as an inheritance by lot to your families. To the many you shall increase the inheritance, and to the few you shall decrease its inheritance. Wherever its lot shall fall, shall it be, according to the tribes of your fathers shall you inherit. But if you do not drive out the inheritance of the land before you, those of them who you leave shall be pins in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they will harass you upon the land in which you dwell." And here's the key verse. "And it shall be that what I meant to do to them, I shall do to you." Let me tell you a little story. I was one time with a mutual friend of ours in a weekend seminar out in the north. And one of the articulators of the two-state solution and land giveaway plans was actually speaking at this weekend retreat. His name is Amram Mitzna. And I basically got up and asked a question. I said, he explained the two-state solution. I said, well, now finally I understand the verse in this week's Torah portion. The plan was we should push them out of the land. But now, since we haven't done that, I see you articulating the plan that they should push us out of the land.
And what did he say?
He said what he said. It was nothing special. But the bottom line is that it was actually in this week's Torah portion. That's why I always remember that discussion that I had. And there were some people who were very upset with me, and they wanted me to actually stop speaking at that weekend retreat. And then somebody, our mutual friend, said to the organizers, he said, "Well, if you didn't like Ishai's question, which was said with a lot of respect, it was respectfully said, why don't we just cancel Torah reading tomorrow morning? Because he asked a question out of the Torah. If he's not right to say that, then let's not read the Torah portion." And I was summarily reinstated. So these are tough questions, and indeed we are being harassed by people within our land.
And indeed we have not driven them out. And I have to tell you that I find this deeply challenging, because on one level, it is an unequivocal statement. I mean, you could read it, by the way, I've done this with myself, okay? I could isolate it to that particular historical period, right? There was a commandment from God to drive out the seven nations because, in order to establish the Jewish people, Am Yisrael, we weren't even Jews yet, we were Am Yisrael, right? There needed to be an open space. But then you could say, but that was a commandment for its own time. Now, if it weren't for the fact that we seem to be living through this cycle again in our own time, I would leave it there. And I feel deeply challenged by, on one hand, the empathy and sense of mercy I have for the real suffering which is going on around us, leaving aside whose fault it is and responsibility. And you and I could definitely roll that all the way back, a couple hundred years if we wanted to. But I just have a lot of empathy. I see the suffering of the Arabs around us and say, like, really? Really? Is this what we're called to do? On the other hand, I watch what's happening in terms of my friends that were driven out of Gush Katif. And my friends and neighbors who aren't necessarily
the safe. Communities of Gaza Strip.
Yes, thank you. And my friends and neighbors who aren't necessarily safe to even drive the roads around their homes in Yudan Shomron. And I really wonder. And in that light, that tension to me is encapsulated in something that the Chatam Sofer, early 19th century leader of German-Hungarian Jewry, he asked a brilliant question. He said, wait a minute, This commandment was given to a people who had been slaves for 210 years. They'd wandered in the desert for 40 years. There they were at the edge of a good green land in a time when people just killed each other and took things. So what was the Havamina? What would they think they were going to do other than take the land? Why did God have to command us to do it? And his answer is brilliant. He said, because the nature of the Jewish people is to be merciful and to be kind and to be tolerant. And so therefore we had to be commanded to do this. And by the way, you know what? You open up the book of Joshua and Judges, and we didn't do it. We didn't do it. And
and that's the one thing that Joshua is kind of castigated for,
yes,
rebuked for.
Not finishing that job. And at the same time, it also forces me to wonder, well, if Joshua and the tribes couldn't do it, then are we barking up the wrong tree?
Is this the right nation for this kind of job?
Yeah. Yeah. and if so, like, if you hear the tension, well, but God commanded. Right. And I have a lot of empathy for the left, by the way, because, you know, the left, not
the entirely. The Israeli political left who believes in two-state solution and believes in...
And has largely abandoned the commandments. I mean, not entirely. It's not... I mean, but so you understand, they've abandoned the commandments and they're left with a very natural Jewish nature of being merciful. And unfortunately, I see a lot of my friends on the right who are holding fast the commandments, but there's a level of cruelty that I see in some of my good friends. The sort of callousness, cruelty is perhaps a little too hard, but a callousness that like makes me wonder, who would we be if we actually did finish this job?
That is indeed a tension, and indeed a tension of our time. We're going to get back to that tension right after the break. You are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. We're going to step out for a little bit, but we'll be right back with more of Rabbi Mike Foyer.
This is Eve Harrow of Rejuvenation at Voice of Israel. It's been almost a year since Voice of Israel began our global broadcast, and we are so proud and excited to announce our new long-awaited website. So if you want continued professional internet content with opinion makers and trendsetters from Israel, the Middle East, and the world, you need a professional source. You need Voice of Israel. You can choose between a variety of packages. Visit voiceofisrael.com and click on subscribe.
All right, folks, we're back here on Spiritual Cafe with Rabbi Mike Foyer on the Yishai Fleischer Show. We're talking about taking out the enemies, getting rid of the people of this land who were not meant to inherit this land. Rather, the Jewish people were, in these tricky biblical passages in the book of Numbers. And we're talking about Torah portion Masa'eh, which is about chapter 33, the end of chapter 33. And... we were talking now about the kind of commandment to get rid of those nations, but one thing that we didn't touch yet is the issue of their high places, their mm-hmm. high places, mm-hmm. Their places of idolatry or worship. You gotta crush those high places. Now, every single Muslim in this region knows that when you take over a piece of land, if there's a church there, you knock out that church, you turn it into a mosque. They know that you basically destroyed their high places. That, you know. ISIS knows that. Everybody knows that. That's like simple language. And I've always thought exactly how you explained in the last quarter that the reason that the Torah had to step kind of out and explain to us the idea that you have to destroy their high places is because that's not in our nature. That's exactly how yeah. my thinking was. At the same time, and coincidentally, quote unquote, I was on the bus coming here right now, and I was listening. Rabbi Yehuda Glick was on the radio, and mm-hmm. he was nearly assassinated. He's a Temple Mount activist and also a peace activist. And he was saying unequivocally that the majority of jihadist ideology in our region right now is stemming forth from the Temple Mount. He says that most, if not all, of the terror attacks in Jerusalem have come from local Jerusalem Arabs who have been swayed, Muslims who have been swayed by the rhetoric on the Temple Mount. And my friend Alex Trayman said to me once, and I'll never forget, he said this, the root of propaganda and anti-Semitism in the land of Israel comes from our holiest place. In every single picture of terrorists and jihadis, there's a picture of that Temple Mount in our background. The very place that is supposed to be this incredible light somehow gets turned around, and when it's reprocessed through the ideas of jihad, it becomes like this beacon of darkness. Beacon of darkness. And that's exactly what this incredible phrase, which is really a blood-chilling phrase in the Bible, "V'haya kasher damiti lasot lahem eseh lachem," and it shall be that what I meant to do to them, I shall do to you, i.e., kick you off of the land. And it was the last in this Ramadan that's just ending this weekend with the holiday of Eid al-Fitr. This Ramadan has been one in which the Muslims have had incredible success on the Temple Mount, all due to the technical assistance of the State of Israel for that. And there's a big sign that says Jews are not allowed to enter until the end of Ramadan. So there's definitely a sense that the things are exactly backwards and that the State of Israel is aiding in the prayer of Muslims and disabling the prayer of Jews.
Well, I mean, just on a visual level, if I were a Muslim, as long as the Dome of the Rock stood on the Temple Mount, this is an occupied Muslim city. I mean, the spiritual heart of the city shows that it's Muslim, and for the Jews to be claiming it's our city, or I'll put it to you another way. I have a friend who's a peace activist, and he told me he was at a meeting with a Palestinian peace activist, and he went to speak to a group of Christians actually fighting against the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanction movement. Together, Jew and an Arab went, and so they're in a cab on the way back. And my friend decided to ask this Palestinian, a good opportunity, what do you think about letting Jews pray on the Temple Mount? He figured, I mean, this is a peace activist, so he would be willing to hear our narrative. He said the explosive response he got was beyond all proportion, and the core message he had was there was never a temple there, and I can prove it to you. Well, what's the proof? If there was really a temple there, you wouldn't let the mosque stand. And this is exactly what you're saying, is that we're dealing with a culture that takes it for granted that if something is holy and it belongs to you, you don't allow someone else to occupy it. And I think that what you're looking at here is really a broken heart at the heart of Am Yisrael, is that we as Jews, a fraction of us really want that and believe that there is a way to bring God's presence to earth, to dwell in the land, but the majority of us don't. And it is more than convenient that that sacred place be not in our hands. I think that that is what's really driving this.
And fear of, I think that there is an underlying fear of the meeting between the Jewish people and God. A lot of people just don't want to get that close.
Yeah, either they don't believe it could be, or you're right, or they're afraid of what it would mean.
I think that Israelis, at least at the day after 1967, believed it could be.
Well, there was a missed opportunity there.
But the day after, it took some time for them to realize, like, God just showed up, and I need a little bit of distance from him.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, but you know, there's a famous broadcast from Moshe Dayan to one of the generals in the turning point of the 73 war. And when the Syrians were about to make their breakthrough, which was thankfully stopped by really miraculous means of like 15 tanks, you know, against the whole Syrian army.
Yeah, that and they had visions of like some kind of like mystical mother, like Rachel Imenu in the heavens.
They're incredible stories. But either way, the statement that was made by Moshe Dayan to one of the generals in the north was that the third temple is about to fall.
Right.
Right. And you see in this the understanding that many of these secular Zionists saw the state itself as the embodiment of the return. And therefore, it made perfect sense that they didn't want the Temple Mount, because not only was it frightening, and it was a challenge. It is a challenge. It is an alternative vision for what it means to be a people in our land. And it's not a secular, political, military vision. It's a divine vision.
So the Torah portion, these two Torah portions, this is a very long kind of Torah reading, and you have all these technical things. You have, as we said, the borders, and you also have all kinds of laws in there, the laws of oaths, mm-hmm. the laws of kashrut. How do you kasher? How do you make things after you've taken them from the enemy? How do you make them
part of the collective possessions of Am Yisrael?
How do you sanctify them? Mm-hmm. How are you able to use these things, because they have a certain kind of how do we say tuma?
Impurity
that we can't really use. And that's also the issue of the land of Israel. The land of Israel need to be purified. You have to come in. You have to have a just war. You have to divide it in the godly fashion. And the lots were going to determine that.
I mean, the parallel is perfect to what you're saying, because ultimately the land of Israel is meant to be one of the two primary vessels for relationship with God. There's always the Torah. That's the primary vessel, and that's why in exile we survived and we maintained that relationship. But for the people as a whole to enter into that intimacy of relationship, the land is the vessel.
And the operative verse here, exactly how you're saying it, is at the end of chapter 35. It says, "You shall not contaminate the land in which you dwell, in whose midst I rest, for I, God, rest among the children of Israel." That's exactly what you're talking about. Rabbi Mike Foyer, I want to thank you so much for joining me on Spiritual Cafe. Our time is done.
That's always a lot to talk about.
But what do we say at the end of Torah portions, at the end of books? We say, Chazak, Chazak, Venit Chazek. We should be strengthened. We should be strengthened. And we should keep going on that journey, on that mission, and come into the land of Israel to purify it, to sanctify it, and to make it an abode for God's resting place. Thank you so much, Rabbi Mike.
Amen.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom to you out there. Stay tuned, stay strong, and stay connected.
VoiceOfIsrael.com. Tune in on your PC, tablet, or smartphone, at home, at work, or on the go. Listen to our live stream with just the click of a button, or catch it later on demand. Also, don't miss our hot topic exclusive interviews with top leaders, policymakers, and diverse personalities. Voice of Israel, your source for news and views on everything Israel and the Middle East.